We're your health and safety angels, Daisy Silcock
and Lindsay Mason. Health and safety,
busting the barriers. Hello and welcome to this episode of the Health and Safety Angels. I hope you're all doing well. I've got a bit of a cold, so I probably sound a bit husky, a bit sexy, maybe not.
Bringing a new edge to the podcast.
Yes. Well, a new revenue stream, perhaps, you know, a second career if this one fails.
Just
how
be
are
careful.
You, Linz? Be careful of what? What am I going to be careful of?
Well, it sounds sexy until you make too much noise, which then instigates a cough, and then you end up coughing down the microphone, which takes away the sexiness.
That, yes, I completely agree.
So just be mindful.
Yeah. I'll mute myself. I should have bought a glass of water, really, for this.
Oh, rookie mistake.
I'm not prepared at all.
I've gone the other way, though. I've got fizzy pop, which is really not the greatest drink when you're speaking and recording in, potentially.
No, not at all. Yeah. You'll be holding them all in.
Or I could just embrace myself and just not. No, that would be disgusting.
Yeah, I think that would be a step to, I think we'd lose even more listeners.
There's nothing you're going to do that's going to lose listeners. But maybe me having a bit of fizzy pop might put a few people off.
We're back on Riddor.
Oh, I really loved that last episode. Very, very interesting. Some of those cases are just, it's just unbelievable what goes on, isn't it? Nothing shocks me, but it still makes me go, God, what is going on with some human beings? But it was very interesting.
Right. So, I wanted to talk about something, and I'm sort of half considering that we need to do this as an episode on its own. And by the way, listeners, Lindsay is hearing about this for the first time because she's got no idea what I'm about to say. So I've just come back from a trip to Belfast, as you know, Lindsay.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm on edge.
And I know you are. And one of the things that Belfast, they kind of really sell now in terms of tourism, is the connection with the Titanic.
Okay.
And she's thinking, where's this going? Right. Okay. So basically, Titanic, we're talking about a major health and safety failure. That's the Titanic, yeah?
Yeah.
So from the get-go, there are safety failings that occurred, and this combination of these safety failings resulted in, what was it, 1,300 people dying? And safety failings that started from design all the way through, because if you remember, one of the key things about the Titanic was that there was not enough lifeboats, yeah?
Okay, I thought that, well, maybe you're going to bring it up, I thought it was the capsules that they created so that the water had a chance to pass through, like it didn't have fire stopping itself.
Well, yeah, so that was really interesting because they had like these 18 sections. I don't know what the technical terms are. Somebody will be listening to this saying, I think they're called bulkheads, but I don't know if that's the right term. But basically there were 18 sections and the walls in between them weren't built to the top. Had they been built to the top, the water wouldn't have been able to flow from one to the other, to the other, to the other. But one of the really interesting things, because I'm a geek, as you know, and as the listeners are fully aware, prior to going to Belfast, and we stayed at this hotel called the Titanic, and we went to the Titanic Museum and did all that sort of touristy stuff. Prior to that, I was watching documentaries, I was reading articles, all the kind of geeky stuff that you would expect of me. And there was so much stuff, so much that I didn't know about. For example, the whole stuff, the whole premise about the Titanic being unsinkable. Yeah. I mean, how many times, Linz, have you heard people say, I've never had an accident, I'm never going to have an accident?
I think most people I come across believe it's never going to happen to them.
Well, that's what they believed about the Titanic. And look how wrong that was. And so even, you know, we're over 100 years on, people are still believing that same mentality that it's not going to happen to me. So I don't know whether we can, I don't know if we can like pander me in a little special episode. Listeners, would you be interested in hearing my musings on the Titanic? Because there was so many different things, including the fact that 8 people died building the Titanic. And the irony with the 8 people that died was that 3 of them, they didn't even know the names of them.
Oh, no.
Because they were... Oh, yeah. They were literally people that were hired on the day and died on the day they were hired to work on the you know, in the dockyards at Belfast.
Did they find out who they were afterwards?
No, they're on the, there is like various plaques in this, the Titanic region area. I think it's, I don't know what it's called, Titanic area or something like that, of Belfast. And there is actually a plaque of the names that they knew, the five names that they knew, but then the three names that are unknown are literally unknown.
Wow.
A bit like those war graves where they say unknown soldier. Yeah, so there's a lot of stuff. So if anybody is interested, let us know if it's something that would be interested, or any other historical cases, for example, because me and Lindsay are complete and utter geek fanatics. We will find out this information. And if you'd like anything like that, just as a silly little special, then yeah, you could humour me and I could talk about that, because I found it absolutely fascinating. And there were so many things that whilst I was walking around this museum and reading the documents and the books and stuff that I read and watched documentaries and things, there were so many like-for-like similarities with health and safety cases now, and the same excuses and the reasons given that were still being used back in, you know, 1912 and prior, you know. So it was a really fascinating one. So if you're interested, folks, let us know.
Do I get a vote?
Yeah, go on.
I'm very interested.
See, because it's one of those, we all know this story, and it's been dramatised and it's been played out in so many different ways. I think it's a really fascinating one. But looking at it from purely health and safety perspective, and that's where what makes it really interesting. there was even an interview with the captain in, I think it was 1909, so a few years prior to the Titanic setting sail, where the captain was interviewed for some newspaper or something like that, because he was a pretty well-known captain at the time. And he even said in this article, he said, "I've never had a misadventure," as he called it. I think he called it a marine misadventure. He said, "I've never had a marine misadventure. I'm never aware of one. It's never going to happen." And that I just found really interesting. That's exactly the same mentality that we see to this very day. We've learned nothing from all of these horrendous accidents that have happened in so many ways, you know.
He must have been a fairly intelligent man to have the position he had. Isn't it strange that someone who clearly knew a lot to have that role could have such a childish mindset that it would never happen? I don't think I could ever say that to myself. Because you just never know.
No, exactly. And then when you combine that with the fact that just prior to the Titanic, he was the captain of another vessel that did crash into something. Yeah.
This was after that interview, but before the Titanic set sail.
Yeah, yeah. So there's just I think there's a lot of interesting stuff, and there was this amazing, oh my God, I will definitely include a picture of this when we discuss, when it comes out on Instagram and stuff. There is a fantastic picture that I took in the museum, this Titanic Museum in Belfast. Some of you will have been, if you haven't and you're going, fantastic place to visit. At the end of the sort of tour, as it were, they've created these massive dominoes, and on each of the dominoes identifies the failings that led to the disaster. So we're talking domino effect, incident investigation. It was brilliant.
I was properly
wow, that's such a great idea. So look at all the failings and then look at all the control measures that were introduced following it. So from that perspective, completely health and safety. We're talking about a work-related accident, aren't we? We're talking about the fact that they crashed into an iceberg, which they should have been able to avoid, because, you know, lots of other boats were in the water at that time avoiding icebergs without crashing into them. So why didn't it work on this particular occasion? And was it, for example, like, you know, the arrogance of believing, well, even if we crash into an iceberg, we're going to come off better than, you know, the iceberg kind of thing? I don't know, but I just think it's a really interesting one. So yeah, if you fancy it, Linz, you know, I'm happy to while away a little bit of a ridiculous special on something like that.
Yeah, well, do you know what I think is the most interesting? Although I remember watching the National Geographic VHS that we used to have of Titanic and watching it over and over again. But what I like the most is thinking that it's a classic example of how we just don't learn. Even in 2024, there's a prosecution for state of some toilets. Now, I always bring up toilets because we go to site and we have to use the facilities that companies offer. And I was at one recently and I refused to go because it was so bad. And how are we not progressing? How, I mean, I know some businesses are, and I don't know what the percentage would be of how many are at the minimum level or above, but we keep on going over and over and over what we should be doing, what we could be doing, how we can do it better. And it just seems to be a proportion of businesses that just don't learn from what mistakes have been made. I mean, how many years is it since Titanic? 110?
1912, I want to say.
So 112 years and yeah. Companies are still making the same mistakes. It's shocking. At some point, we've got to say, yeah, something's got to change. Come on, people.
But the crazy thing was, so the place we stayed in, which was this place called the Titanic Hotel, which is kind of right opposite the museum, which is a beautiful hotel. And the interesting thing about this hotel is that all around it, the actual building this hotel is in, is the old head office of the company called Harland and Wolff, which have these big, they kind of basically built the Titanic and all that kind of stuff. So you're in these old offices, these old buildings, which is now being converted into this hotel, which is lovely. But around, they've kept a lot of the original features from when this was the headquarters of this building. And they've got like little plaques, almost like a, it's almost kind of like a living museum. And one of the plaques that, again, geekily, I took a picture of was to do with some fireproof doors that they'd kept. So the original fireproof doors from like 1890s or something. So it was really interesting. So the fact that in the 1890s, they were considering fireproof doors and all that sort of stuff, which obviously wouldn't have necessarily been the standard at the time by any stretch of the imagination. And yet they built a boat that had big gaps in it, and you know, they didn't put enough lifeboats and all that sort of stuff. So in some ways they were doing some great things, but then in other ways they were hugely failing.
But if you talk about fire doors, I've been to a number of places recently where as I'm walking along it says fire door keep shut and it's open, or it says fire door keep shut and I can see through the flipping gap in the middle. And so they're using fire doors there, knowing what they're for. And again, 100 and so many years later, we're still not realising how important those things are.
But the one thing I would say about these fire doors, when I was reading this little plaque, it was quite interesting, because it said that at the end of each of the working days, all the original ink and drafting cloth drawings were stored in a fireproof room. So I think the fire doors were more for the boat drawings and the sort of operation critical documents than saving any of the workers by the sounds of it.
It's a shame that there wasn't a fire and we lost the documents of the design, because maybe they would have done it differently.
There is that, yeah.
That would be interesting.
I think even all that way back, it all comes down to money. I mean, if you look at some of the prices that people were paying for tickets on the Titanic, I mean, a first class ticket, I think they said it was in equivalent money, it was about £10,000. So the equivalent, it's like today's money. So if you were in first class, that's how much you would be paying to go on the Titanic. So you'd expect with that number of people at that sort of price that safety would be very, very important. But clearly it wasn't.
Yeah. But they must have cared. Like society must have cared for them to have some of those things in place. Right. So
yeah, because they had some level of procedures, and they had, you know, they had things like life, you know, jackets. So there were some levels of protocol, but obviously it was the tick in the box. That's what it was. I think, you know, there would have been some level of inspection, I'm sure, at the time to make sure it was seaworthy and so on, and it would have been enough to have met those ticks in boxes, I think. And that's what it boils down to, which sadly it's still looking like it's boiling down to for a lot of companies today as well. Anyway, we shall move on from that, and maybe we will do, you know, we'll do
well,
a little
why don't we just
something
say,
on that.
Let's do it anyway, because we're interested.
Yeah, why not, eh?
Let's there do you it. Go. So what are we? We're continuing on today, aren't we? So we had part one of the RIDDOR regulations, and we covered Regulation 3, responsible person. Regulation 4, non-fatal injuries to workers. So it makes sense to move on to five, which is non-fatal injuries to non-workers.
Indeed. So a non-worker, this is where a person that's not at work, so let's give some examples, such as members of the public, visitors, I guess customers, that sort of thing. Slightly depends on the setting. And I deal quite a lot with police authorities. So, for example, a detainee in custody would be classed as a non, you know, person not at work, for example. And so this is where they suffer some sort of work-related accident. So it has to be connected with the working environment and work activities in some way. It can't be like, I don't know, they just came into the shop and they had a heart attack or something like that. It would need to be that they came into a shop and the shelf in the shop landed on their arm and broke their arm or something like that.
So the business undertaking, whether it, whatever that business is doing, either as a service or to be able to run their business, if that element impacts a non-worker, that's going to be reportable. So if I go into a supermarket and one of the products has been spilt and I slip on that product and fall and break a bone, their product has led to my injury and therefore that's going to be reportable.
Yeah, absolutely. There was an example, actually, because I mentioned about police a minute ago, there was an example, and I don't actually know if this was investigated by the HSE, but to me, it would be a definite example of this. So this is relating to a police force here in Wales. And basically, they had a guy that they were bringing into custody. And in fairness, the video of this is actually on, I shouldn't giggle, but it's on like YouTube, this video. I giggle because the man's actually naked as they're bringing him into the cell. At 41, I shouldn't be giggling at a naked man. I know that. But obviously, there's some reason why he's naked. I don't know. And that has no prevalence in the story, by the way. It's just a point. But several...
Yeah, he's just naked.
Several officers are bringing him into this cell. And the protocol, so I'm led to believe, is that when you close a cell door, because they're very heavy, you want to kind of close it gently shut. Because if you slam the cell door, it will kind of bounce back and actually it won't lock. So you kind of, you know, you can push it so far and then within perhaps like, you know, a couple of inches, you'd have to just kind of slowly push it closed and then it would lock.
That goes against everything we think about people being put in jail. Because isn't it,
in the slammer, yeah. Maybe when it was like a lock and key situation. But I think now because it's a bit more perhaps centrally locked, maybe it's like electronic locks.
Is it?
Oh, I guess so now.
I've not been in a cell, I don't know.
Well, I have, but only in like museum jails. And they've always been like the old sort of bolt locks.
Gulliver's Land.
So this guy, I don't know what he's in custody for. He's giving the officers a bit of a hard time and there's a lot of kind of, you know, I don't know, fighting and stuff going on. But he's trying to obviously get away. Not that he's going to get very far with the amount of officers that are around him. But anyway.
I've got a feeling I'm kind of guessing what you're going to say. But
I shouldn't laugh.
Maybe that's just me.
I'm terrible. Anyway, so... Basically, what happened is that...
I'm already laughing because I'm guessing what you're going
to
say.
No, it's got nothing to do with that. I know that what you're thinking and probably the listeners, it's nothing to do with the nakedness part of him.
Oh, darn it. That's what I was thinking.
I would have shared that story, to be honest. I think by the calibre of our listeners, they would have definitely laughed at that. So anyway, instead of that getting trapped, as they slam the cell door, which they shouldn't have done, which was against the protocol, they trapped four of his fingers in the door. And three of those fingers came almost immediately amputated. Yes.
No.
There was obviously, they could hear him screaming and yelling, but he was screaming and yelling before they closed the door. So they just kind of felt that he was like continuing on with this. I think
Oh, no, they didn't even know.
They saw blood. And that's what made them go, oh, whoops. And then they obviously opened the cell door. And then he went off to hospital. And yeah, so... and it was all caught on CCTV. And that CCTV has been leaked onto YouTube and such. So you can kind of see all of this. And then since then, they have actually made the change of installing finger guards, which are... in fact, you probably have seen a similar type of thing if you've ever been to like a school or a nursery or something like that. It's but usually we would see finger guards on the bit where you open the door attaches to the wall bit, the brackety bit. Usually the finger guards would be on the bracket side of it as the door, the hingy section.
Yes.
That's the menopause brain. So usually the finger guards would be on the hinge section, whereas on these cells, they're on that section, on the closing section, so that if anyone does ever have their fingers in the way again, it will protect from that kind of reoccurrence. I don't know whether this, by the way, just a little point about this person that was in custody. I don't know what happened and whether he was then charged with whatever it is he did wrong in the first place. I don't know about that bit, but... yeah, so, and I don't know whether this particular police force was investigated by the HSE, but to me, that would be a classic example of a non-worker having a work-related accident because they didn't follow their own procedure when...
which is why we have them.
On how to close the door. Have they followed the procedure, the guy would not have been injured. So...
well, there's two parts. So I'm looking at Regulation 5 now, and it says where any person not at work as a result of a work-related accident suffers, and then it splits into two. You've got A and B. A is suffers an injury, and that person is taken from the site of the accident to a hospital for treatment in respect of that injury. So they have to need hospital attention and go immediately from that accident site to a hospital. They can't have gone home and then go to hospital afterwards.
Because I think with this, I mean, the example I've just gave would be a prime example of that, because yes, this person did go from the police, you know, custody straight to hospital for obviously dealing with amputated fingers.
We say obviously because of what it is. However, that's the one of the cases last week was where someone had they had burns and they didn't even give them any first aid.
Yeah, of course.
So it's and then we've got B, which is suffers a specified injury on hospital premises.
So any of those specified injuries that are specified in Regulation 4, those would be classed as things that if they happened whilst at hospital premises, because obviously, you know, chances are you're going to go straight to hospital anyway. But any of those things happening to like members of the public, for example, then it would obviously class under there as well. But just to come back to that point that you made about going home, and this is something which there are lots of examples of this. And the example I always use is about an accident happening in a school to a school pupil. So obviously they're not a worker, and perhaps an accident happens, maybe there's a loose roof tile, or maybe the gardener is chopping down a bit of tree and it lands on a child or something like that. The important bit is that they go from the scene of the incident to hospital directly. So as Lindsay said before, they're not going home and then later on that evening they're off to hospital. No, they have to go from the site of the accident to the hospital. That's not us saying that. That's what the law says. That's the specification. That's the kind of the format, the remit that is set by the government within the legislation. So they're very specific on that. So that has to be the case. So if something happened a different way around, then it wouldn't necessarily be then reportable.
Right. So this is in terms of criminal law, is we have a legal duty to report if they're taken to hospital straight from the scene. It doesn't mean if they get hurt at your premises, then they go home, then they go to hospital. It doesn't mean that you're not responsible for it, because they can still make a compensation claim but it's just in terms of legally reporting.
Absolutely.
It.
And it doesn't mean that if even if it's not reportable under Riddle, that it's not going to result in criminal proceedings or a visit from the HSE, because obviously, like we said on our last episode in relation to Riddle, a clear, glaringly obvious omission from this law is to do with noise. So there's nothing to say that somebody, you know, you could lose, you could end up affecting somebody's hearing significantly, which if you haven't controlled that noise, it would be a breach of the control of noise at work regs. But because it's not specified under RIDOR, you wouldn't actually have to inform the incident contact centre in the same way that you would for other things. So, yeah, it's not to get confused with whether you are compliant with other legislation or not. You know, if it's not on this list of things that we're discussing, it doesn't mean that you're kind of plain sailing or anything like that.
Well, thank you for clarifying
that.
My
pleasure, as always.
So I guess we move on to six.
Yes. It's only... baby cough, then it was all right.
Okay. Well, that was more of a throat clear than a cough. I let you off. Right. Six, work-related fatalities. So six is split into four sections. So section one, where any person dies as a result of a work-related accident, the responsible person must follow the reporting mm-hmm. procedure. So they've had a physical accident.
Yeah, and with this one, of course, the term any person. So now we're not stipulating whether this is a worker or non-worker. This is anybody who dies as a result of anything to do with the working environment, an accident relating to the work environment. So obviously on the podcast already, we've covered lots of different examples of work-related deaths, you know. So whether that's a member of the public, whether that is a worker, it has to be reported irrespective of who they are and that side of it. But obviously it has to connect with the working environment. So the example I gave before about the person going into the shop and having the heart attack, if they then died of that heart attack, then no, that would not be reportable, because the heart attack was, I guess you could class it as natural causes, as it were. But if they went into the shop, the shelf fell on top of them, and then they died from that, then yes, that would be a work-related accident and work-related fatality, and would have to be reported. And the important thing with the death side of things is that you have to pick up that call, pick up that phone and make that call to the incident contact centre as quickly as possible. It is imperative that you let them know immediately. I think the term is actually by the quickest possible means. So pick up the phone, give them a call, let them know that this thing has happened. You're not having to at this stage provide them with huge amounts of information, because you may not know that massive amounts of information at that time. And obviously you would have to then later on fill in reports and that sort of thing regarding it. But you would have to let them know. And you will get your HSE visit with a fatality. Okay,
right.
So that's an important thing to note. We have discussed previously in other episodes about the sort of staff shortages within the HSE as a government organisation. But one of the things that they are, you know, the kind of priority list is to make sure that they attend all work-related fatalities. So you are guaranteed to get that visit.
You also have to be mindful that the law and the guidance doesn't give you 100% an amount of time. But I always say to people, imagine if you had to stand in front of a judge and the judge says to you, it took you 72 hours to report this death. You would have to justify how that was literally the first available opportunity you had to make that call. And I'm not sure there's very much you could say that would justify that kind of way.
No, absolutely not. I mean, this is like, that would be like you not ringing the police for 72 hours, you know.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about an enforcing authority. So we're talking about the fact that they have the right under law to be there and to begin that investigation as the police would be, you know. So the chances are that if a work-related fatality has occurred, that you would be ringing 999 immediately, getting ambulances and police and fire and whoever else was required. And the next phone call down the line, the official phone call, should be to the HSE to let them know. I mean, of course, you would also want to have ring companies like your insurance company, because undoubtedly they'll probably be supplying you with some of the legal support. And of course, we've had our episode with Mary Lawrence, which is obviously a fantastic episode, on Section 36 and 37, where she spoke about that as well, calling the insurance company, and the insurance company would advise you on that side of things. But absolutely, you don't want to be, you know, I think realistically that 24 hours should not go by without you picking up the phone and ringing the HSE.
I mean, yeah, I would go as far as saying 12. But anyway, that's picking, nitpicking. So we've also then got section
I'm
two.
I'm going to say
so
11.
She one-upped me. Section two, which is really, it's exactly the same. It's just breaking down that it's a different form of death. So where any person dies as a result of occupational exposure, so workplace exposure, to a biological agent, the responsible person must follow the reporting procedures. Section three, where an employee has suffered an injury reportable under Regulation 4, so it's a specified injury or a dangerous occurrence or whatever it is that's specified, but then which is a cause of his death within 1 year of the date of the accident. The employer must notify the relevant enforcing authority of the death in an improved manner without delay, whether or not the injury has been reported under Regulation 4. So where an employee has suffered an injury that is reportable that then leads to their death within a year of that date of accident, you have to report it. Or the death in an approved manner without delay, whether or not the injury has been reported under Regulation 4. So actually, even if it's not reportable and they die following it, you've got to report it.
So a fatality which occurs 1 year after the date of the accident. So imagine, for example, that one of the examples under Regulation 4 as a specified injury was a crush injury of, say, the torso, chest, stomach area. And this person, off they pop to hospital, and they're there for a long period of time with serious internal injuries. And then eventually, maybe, you know, I don't know, 2 or 3 months later, they then die as a result of that. That then becomes a work-related fatality. So effectively, you've already reported it because you have to as a specified injury under Regulation 4, and then you report it again as a work-related fatality because they've died as a result of that. And of course, then it is amplified, that level of injury and harm that they've resulted in. And then the other one on that list, of course, is the biological bit. So I just wanted to define what the biological, because Lindsay spoke about dying from exposure to a biological agent. We're talking about, let's go with the definition under the COSH regulations. So microorganisms, cell culture, or a human endoparasite. Which causes an infection, an allergy, toxicity, or otherwise creates a hazard to human health. So I think, yeah, anthrax is a great example, because obviously there have been cases, there must have been cases here in the UK, but definitely aware of anthrax cases in America, where postal workers and things like that were exposed to anthrax that was sent to them. Sent to their places of work and things like that, and then workers have died as a result of it, and contracted viruses and such. So, you know, if that situation occurred where a worker was exposed to something and then they died as a result of it, which was classed as a biological agent, then yeah, it would then be classed as a work-related fatality.
And must be reported.
And must be reported. Yes.
Just thought I'd finish the sentence there.
Yes.
Then we've got one more bracketed section, which is subsection 4 of Regulation 6. This regulation is subject to Regulations 14 and 15, which we haven't covered yet, and does not apply to a self-employed person who suffers a fatal accident or fatal exposure on premises controlled by that self-employed person. So if I am working for myself, running my own workplace, and I die at that workplace through a physical accident or an exposure to a biological agent, that is not reportable. So we've covered five and we've covered six. So we're moving on to regulation seven. So I'll read it out and then Daisy can give you a little bit more information.
Not much to read this one.
Well, that's why I like it. You can do the heavy stuff. So regulation seven, where there is a dangerous occurrence, which I'll let Daisy explain what that is, the responsible person must follow the reporting procedure subject to regulations 14 and 15.
Okay, so yeah, this is your dangerous occurrence, which is effectively a ginormous near miss. So a near miss is the almost accident. So this is where you almost were harmed or injured. But imagine that on a huge sort of massive scale. So we're talking about a variety of different examples that we can give. And actually there are examples within like an appendices to this regulation, which is one of the schedules that they call, which are sort of little attachments to the regulations. So there's lots of different examples. So we've got things like train collisions, fires involving faulty electrics. We've got things like collapse of lifting equipment. So maybe your forklift truck mast fails and the load just crashes to the ground. But the important thing with all of these examples is that they are examples where no one was harmed or injured. But because of the severity of what we're actually talking about, it's so serious that it could have then caused multiple fatalities, for example, and therefore the HSE want to know about it. And given a few more HSE inspectors, they will try and get around as many dangerous occurrences as they can because of the severity of some of these incidents. You know, we're talking about things like excavations collapsing, maybe scaffolding collapsing, that sort of thing. So really serious incidents. And this is why they would obviously want to look at what's happened, why it's happened, and of course what the organisation's going to do to rectify those issues.
Well, the HSE website says dangerous occurrences are certain specified near miss events. Mm-hmm. Not all such events require reporting. There are 27 categories of dangerous occurrences that are relevant to most workplaces. For example, the collapse, overturning or failure of load-bearing parts of lifts and lifting equipment, plant or equipment coming into contact with overhead power lines, the accidental release of any substance which could cause injury to any person. And then it's also got a link, if you're on the webpage, that says further guidance on these dangerous occurrences is available. So there is a section you can go to research those 27 categories.
Yeah. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think there's one, she says, looking at the same time, which is always a bit of a...
Well, there is a little extra bit that I didn't read, which says...
Do the extra bit while I'm looking.
Yeah, I had your back there. Sorry. I had that covered.
Thank you.
That's all right. It says additional categories of dangerous occurrences apply to mines, quarries, offshore workplaces and relevant transport systems, railways, etc.
Yeah.
So there are more.
There is loads and they kind of break them down. One of them is to do with diving operations. And so, for example, you've got the failure, damaging or endangerment of any life support equipment. So if you imagine if you've got like breathing apparatus and the breathing apparatus fails whilst you're, you know, about to do this activity, but don't worry, we've saved you, it's all right. But the fact that had that been any other set of circumstances, that person could have died, for example. We've got a diver becoming trapped, an explosion in the vicinity of the diver, for example. Now, the reason I'm pointing out these is that we've done a little bit of research, as we tend to do for these episodes, and I've got an example of where an organization was served an improvement notice for failing to report a near miss, so a dangerous occurrence, as it would be under the legislation, in reference to a diver. So basically we've got a company that was doing some diving operations, and it said that this particular incident where a diver's precise location was not known, and as a result, the diver who was working just below the surface was struck on by the propeller of the outboard engine of the boat. So he was hit on his fin, so it wasn't enough to actually cause him any injury. But had he been hit on something else, you know, actually part of his body, then you can imagine being struck by propeller, the kind of damage that would do to a person's body. And they failed to report that. And as such, they were served with an improvement notice. So obviously they had a sort of limited period of time in which to make changes so that they not only prevent that incident from happening again, but also ensuring that the responsible person does actually in future report those types of incidents when they occur.
Lovely. I mean, I did actually then picture what would happen, and that wasn't very pleasant, but we have to do
that,
right?
Kind of, because in my head, I had like one of those images from Jaws.
Yes, yeah. I did as well. Yeah. Exactly the same. Isn't that funny? Maybe that's a generational thing.
Yes, probably.
It's what we grew up with.
Yeah. So what have we covered so far then? We've done 3, 4, 5, 6 and 7. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of information, huh?
Ooh la la. Do you know, it's funny when you're teaching the riddle stuff, it's probably done and dusted in about 5-10 minutes, isn't it? Because you just have no time to really go into depth. So it's quite nice to actually take the time and sort of really sit and discuss it. Actually, today I was teaching a NEBOSH class, and one of the students we were talking about a past exam question, and it was relating to legal arguments that you would give, in relation to why we should bother with health and safety. And I actually said to this particular student, I said, we do actually have a podcast episode that you might want to listen to that might help, because all the information is obviously in your textbook, but sometimes people find it useful hearing it rather than, or watching a video or something like that, rather than just sitting and reading text. So
absolutely, that's exactly why we do what we do, right? Because it's just an alternative way of people learning. And it may be you've read it and read it and read it, and sometimes just listening to us have a little natter on might help you just to see it slightly differently or pick up something you hadn't picked up
before.
Absolutely.
And I said to this guy, I said, look, I said, it's not like a sales pitch, because obviously me and Lynn don't get anything for this. We're not like influencers or anything like that. I said, but it's, as you say, sometimes it's looking at those different styles of learning and also being able to do it in your own pace. Because I guess one of the things with these podcasts is that you can kind of split it into little chunks. You can go back and revisit sections. And we've actually had lots of messages through our personal social media and also from like LinkedIn and that sort of thing, where people have said, I'm studying for this, I'm studying for that, and your podcast has been really useful. So that's ultimately what it's there for. You know, we said this from the beginning, that the work that we do on this is not for really people like us, because we hope that most of the people like us probably know this stuff already, or they certainly should do. This is for everybody else who doesn't know it, who perhaps is wanting to start or in this industry or is a business owner, or maybe even just an employee wanting to know a little bit more about what their organisation should be doing. Wherever, kind of whatever path led you to this, we hope that you're finding it really, really beneficial. We're thoroughly enjoying recording this, aren't we, Linz?
Absolutely. I definitely learn stuff. There's cases that I've not heard about before that you bring up. I also think one thing I've always said is that if you're in health and safety, very few people that know everything. Mm. So there will be people that specialise in manual handling, for example, or COSH, but they don't know everything. And actually, sometimes just having a little listen may even be beneficial for someone that's in the industry, just to expand their knowledge, maybe see it a different way. Because a lot of the things we talk about, you know, the law is open to interpretation in some aspects. Yeah. And it can be quite good to hear how someone else explains something or sees it, especially as generations change and our views change a little bit to how we treat people.
Absolutely. And I think where we try and get examples of things that have happened in real life, that also kind of keeps it more relevant. And so that side of it, I'm definitely finding really useful, because it's that research side of it, where you're looking at cases, you're looking at what's happened, and you're trying to look at it from both sides, you know, of the victim side, as well as, well, what could the organisation do to prevent it from happening again? And actually talking about that, I just leads me to one final point, if I can, and that's just a little update on the Ben Leonard case. I've mentioned it several times now. This is the little scout, the 16-year-old scout who died. This inquest, what date are we on now, Linz? It's the 19th of February for us, 2024. This inquest continues, but we have had a little update fairly recently, as it were. And this is that the jury have been, I think they've been sent away for deliberations now. So we're getting closer to the end of this inquest, which is absolutely fantastic. And basically, the jury have been told by the coroner that they ultimately need to come to some decision, obviously, and that he recommends to consider unlawful killing as the conclusion.
I didn't know a judge could recommend.
Well, maybe actually slightly didn't know different that. In like a coroner's court. I don't know if that's slightly different. But ultimately, if the jury comes to the decision of unlawful killing, then that will then be investigated from a criminal perspective then. And potentially we could be looking at gross negligence, manslaughter, health and safety breaches, etc., etc. So this is just one case that's literally caught my eye, simply because, of course, this young boy died on the Great Orme, which is in Llandudno, just down the road from where I am. And it's something that I've followed this inquest, because it's been, you know, it's a child at the end of the day, and it's definitely been dramatic, to say the least. So it'll be really interesting to see what the jury decide. But ultimately, if the jury kind of decide that no, it was not an unlawful killing, this case will be dropped, and that family will be told, you just got to move on.
Wow. Which, wow. Yeah,
considering everything that's been said up to this point about no risk assessments, no first aid and so on, I can't see the jury deciding that. Can't see it myself.
I can't. No. I can't see it. You wouldn't be able to justify that based on everything we've heard, which you've done a very amazing job of sharing with us, actually. I can't see that would, there'd be something weird going on if that came about.
Yeah.
So keep us updated, because actually it's interesting for everyone to be able to see what's actually going on, how it actually pans out in the real world, not just in the textbook.
Yeah, and how long these processes take. I mean, you know, we've been discussing this in several episodes now, and obviously by the time this particular episode airs, it's going to be a few weeks down the line from that. So hopefully, as you're listening to this, if you search, you type in to Google Ben Leonard, you will already see the outcome, and hopefully it is a positive one, and Ben and his family get that sort of justice, as it were, that they deserve. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting case, because effectively everything that's been said, you know, as far as the news outlets have reported, it would indicate that this was an unlawful death, and it shouldn't have happened, and it could have easily been prevented, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we shall find out what happens.
Yes.
Very soon.
And we'll finish on with our Riddle journey. Gosh, 3 episodes on Riddle. Who would have believed it?
I know.
You know?
I love it.
Indeed.
It's all interesting. Now, I have 2 things to say before we round up.
Go.
One, I flipping watched the post office and we didn't talk about it. And I am shocked. So we need to make
next
a mental note. Please ask me about it.
We can now properly talk about Mr. Bates versus the post office. Yes.
Shocking. Yes. And 2, did you get anything for Valentine's Day?
Did I get anything for Valentine's Day? Oh, yes, I did. I got some chocolate.
Did you?
Yes.
Oh.
And we went out. So I say we, listeners, this is me and my son, the ultimate Valentine.
Absolutely.
So we went out for dinner, because that's what we do on Valentine's. It's great. People watching, by the way. Great. Even if you're not in a couple, go out on Valentine's. It's amazing just to watch couples. The best type of couples are the ones who are obviously recently together and it's really awkward. Love it. So fun to watch. But no, so we go out for dinner, me and my son, and we turned up at the restaurant that we had booked, and it was closed. Yes, I know.
Oh no.
And we've had confirmation and everything like that. But it is actually a chain of restaurants here in North Wales. So we ended up getting a free meal out of it. So that was all right.
Lovely.
We got free pizzas. It was lovely. So yeah, great Valentine's. What did you get for Valentine's?
Nothing. Not a text message.
That's not true. I sent you a happy Galentine's Day.
Yes, you did. You did.
And you didn't even reply.
I must have been doing something.
Batting away all the offers and Valentine's cards.
Yes, yeah, I was too busy. I was drowning under the sea of cards at my front door.
You couldn't even get out the door, could you, that day?
It just was so restrictive, I couldn't even type back on my phone.
I feel sorry for the post people in Watford on that day.
Yeah, I didn't get anything. And my son came home with some flowers, which I knew weren't for me. But I looked at him and he went, "They're not for you." And I said, "That's all right. Aww. It doesn't matter that I've sacrificed a lot for you, Al. Don't worry. One day you'll think of me." And he went, no, I run out of money. Okay, son.
I get that. I mean, in fairness, my boy did say to me, first thing, as I woke him up that day, because I was working and he was at Holiday Club, first thing he said was, "Will you be my Valentine?"
Oh, shut up. He's so lovely. He is lovely.
But, you know, it reminded me because my dad, as girls, me and my sisters, my dad used to buy us a single rose each and it was just so cute. And so, yeah, it's nice to have a little chivalrous man in the making. Yeah. You know.
Oh, bless. Well, mine used to want to marry me when he was little.
Well, mine does as well. I have had to tell him that that's not
feasible. Yeah, I remember that conversation. Why? But I love you. Now you don't, cheeky git. Getting his girlfriend, taking her out. Do you know what he did? He got a hotel room and he sprinkled petals all over the bed. And he even got a balloon arch. He ordered a balloon arch and blew up the balloons.
Yeah, that's why he ran out of
money. He can't even take his plate to the dishwasher at home for me. This is so unfair. You spend your life bringing them up, doing the best you can for them, and then they just shove it back in your face. One day. One day someone will send me something.
The joys of parenting, hey?
Well, it's been wonderful.
But I hope our listeners got some nice Valentine's.
I'm sure there was some lovely spoiling going on out there.
Yeah, I bet there was. And you deserve it. You're wonderful.
It is nice. I know people say, "Oh, we don't celebrate, it's so fake." But, you know, sometimes we get a bit busy and life can get a little bit, you know, on top of you. And you don't always think about the other person necessarily. And so it's a day that just reminds you to take 5 minutes and actually maybe give them some flowers or give them a treat and tell them you love them.
And the thing is, I don't think that Valentine's has to be reserved to, you know, boyfriends, girlfriends, partners, just whoever you love, tell them you love them.
Well, my friend lives in Spain, she said they don't celebrate it, Valentine's Day, as like a partner relationship. They celebrate it as a day of love. So,
yeah, I think that's how
I think we should maybe start changing it up a little bit. And making it more about appreciating people.
Whoever you love, just appreciate. Yeah, absolutely, completely. And I know we should do it every day, but we don't. We're very busy and that's life. So I think, just a general appreciation. Because also, it's good for your mental well-being and it's good for their mental well-being.
Absolutely.
That's always. See, I've twisted it back to health.
You're good. Smashing it, Daze. I love hanging out with you. And I know we do this because we want to share health and safety with people, but also like just having a chat.
I know.
You're a blessing.
But it is good that we have a bit of conversation before we start, because obviously that part of the conversation wouldn't necessarily be suitable for
Well, the length of this podcast, it's lucky we had a chat off air. Otherwise, it'd be 3 hours later.
Well, I think, do you remember when we first started this and we were going, there'll be about 15, 20 minutes.
Then we thought, we'll push it to about half hour, and then it went to 45 minutes and now it's like hour.
16 hours later. Ooh.
Oh, what?
By the way, right, when's this episode coming out? What day is this coming out?
Oh, God, let me look. It would be March.
It will be March 6th.
It will be, yes, March 6th.
Right, lovely listeners, just before you go, we are organising on March 8th, so just in 2 days' time, we are doing an Instagram Live, aren't we?
Yeah, it's in my diary. I've put makeup on. No, I haven't.
We're doing an Instagram live. We don't know why. We're just giving it back to you. So for, I don't know, 12:30, I think we said, wasn't it? 12:30, Greenwich Mean Time, on the 8th of March, we will be live on Instagram. You can join us. You can chat. You can ask us questions. You can just have a laugh. Whatever you like, really. It might just be me and Lindsay on there together having a chat as we normally do. But if you have any questions, anything you want to ask, maybe even a free little bit of health and safety advice, a drop-in session, whatever you want to call it, we are going to be, I don't know, for about an hour, do you think, Lindsay?
Yeah, well, you say that. Oh, yeah, it'll be about an hour. It'll be about
6 hours later.
Join us for lunch and dinner.
Yeah, but we're doing it lunchtime, so if you are at work, it's 12:30, you can join us, you can drop in, you can just say hi, give us some feedback on the podcast, make suggestions, whatever you want to do. So if you haven't already, join us on Instagram, follow us on Instagram so that you can see updates on that. It is healthandsafety.angels, and for all sort of updates and bits and pieces like that on the podcast, that's the best place to find us. And thank you once again for listening.
And we always reply to DMs. When people slide in the DMs, we always reply, don't we?
We do eventually, once we've worked out how to do it.
Or one of us has opened it and the other one doesn't know it's there. We've got to get our admin sorted.
Yes, there is that. I know.
Well, I shall see you on part 3 of Riddle.
Indeed. You take care.
Bye.
Bye.